to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. By my count, we're on episode 906, so we're cruising right along. My name is Camden Busey. I am, as usual, in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters in the studio. I've got a really exciting episode today. This is a conversation I've been looking forward to having for some time, and I have two friends of mine all the way from Switzerland calling in, from Zurich, from Basel. I have some wonderful brothers that I'd like to introduce you to. Some of you may know them already. We have with us first Kurt Federle, who is a pastor of a congregation in Basel, which is part of the ERKWB. Kurt's been on our program before. I've interviewed him about his work there, but we've also had him on our Christmas extravaganza back in December. And many people in the OPC that come to General Assembly will know Kurt as well, because he's frequently a fraternal delegate. Welcome, Kurt. It's good to see you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I am excited to have you. And now that I've been to your home, I've got a context for seeing for your office. So now we're going to have you up here in June, so you can see this room, and then you can know what it looks like in person.
Looking forward to it.
Yes. Yeah. We also have with us Florian Viken. Florian is a pastor in Zurich, not too far away from Basel. What is it, about an hour or so driving-wise? And he serves an EPQ, an EPCEW congregation there in Zurich. Welcome, Florian. It's good to have you on the program as well.
Thank you. It's a great privilege to be here.
I love having you both. We've spoken in person for the last couple of years. I've attended this Reformed Colloquium, which has been hosted by Westminster Seminary UK. They've held it in Budapest, and many people from all over Central and Eastern Europe have attended, and also from the UK and Scotland, Ireland, all these places have come to speak about the work of the Reformed Church and specifically Reformed education in Europe. So I've had the privilege to meet with Kurt, who I've known for several years through the OPC. But then Florian, we got to meet last year at this event, and then again this year, as I just returned a couple weeks ago from this trip. Prior to attending the Reformed Colloquium in Budapest, I was able to visit Kurt and his wife Barbara in their home. I was able to preach at the church in Basel and got to see a Reformed tour of Basel. And we drove through Zurich as well as we headed out to the Alps to get to Appenzell. We got the whole west to east and then back again view of at least some of these major cities in Switzerland. It didn't get up to Geneva. I'll have to do that perhaps my next trip out. But it was such a wonderful time. Brothers, did you enjoy your time at the colloquium? Was it as encouraging to you as it was to me?
Very much so, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a great time meeting many, many brothers I already knew.
Yeah.
And new brothers. It was a very encouraging time. Yeah.
Now, Florian, yeah, you spoke likewise at the event last year, and you've got some history with Westminster Seminary UK, don't you?
Yes, yeah. I spoke last year on how important historic confessions are, mm-hmm, in our faith. And I studied at Westminster Theological Seminary in the UK, Newcastle. Mm-hmm. So I have some connections there. Yeah, really good thing, the colloquium. I really appreciated it.
Florian, tell me a bit about your connection, if you might, just some background, your connection to the UK and to how you ended up at Westminster. And frankly, I don't know a whole lot about your family, if you're willing to share anything about it. Are you have an interesting English accent, and I'm wondering where that comes from. It's good. It's a very good accent, but it's not an American accent, and that's for the better. Yeah. So I'm curious what your influences are upon you and why you speak the way you do.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether my wife would appreciate that you said English accent.
She Welsh?
Because my wife is from Scotland.
Scotland.
Yes, so that's kind of part of the explanation. Yeah, but I grew up in the east of Switzerland, mm-hmm, in a Christian home. Not really Reformed. It was more like a dispensational setting. But the first time I got into touch, basically, and connected with Presbyterian churches was in my exchange term in Scotland. Mm-hmm. So I went for half a year to Aberdeen, mm-hmm, to the Free Church there. And that's kind of the first time I connected with Reformed churches. And I was quite surprised, actually, to find conservative Christians who would baptize their children. So that was quite a new thing for me, because my background is totally different. But yeah, then after my studies in business law, I went again to Scotland for a gap year. And I was there for 1.5 years at the Free Church College, it was called back then. I'm just doing a self-study program, and this is basically how I got into Reformed theology, although I wasn't really Reformed then. I was more kind of John MacArthur dispensationalist. Sure. But I met my wife, we got married, we moved back to Switzerland, for me back to Switzerland, yes, and sure. She came with me, and we lived there for 2.5 years, and I started to preach through Acts in my Brethren Church. That's a bit more the background I'm from. And there is much more the continuity rather than the discontinuity of the Old and New Testament. And then just through connections, because I got more and more the sense for the internal calling through connections I already had made in Scotland, I was invited to study at the Westminster Seminary in the UK and also work as an intern there. And really the church, and with help from the States, all my studies were paid, which was just amazing.
Wow.
And afterwards I did a master's degree at Durham University as well, and was sent out to plant the church in Zurich.
That's wonderful. We're going to get into some of that. I know you've done some work on Heinrich Bullinger. We'll speak about him and the Reformation in Zurich and the legacy there and what we'd like to see continue on into the future. But no offense to your wife, certainly not an English accent, Florian. Now that you say it, I definitely can hear the Scot coming through in words like through and whatnot. So there, it's certainly there, and that's a good thing. We appreciate that. Well, it's great to have you both with us. When we're thinking about the cities where you both serve, they're really quite significant. And the Swiss Reformation, of course, is one of the most influential branches of the Protestant Reformation. It's distinct in its own right, distinct from Lutheranism in its ecclesiology and worship, but the movement itself emerged in the early 16th century, primarily in these two cities, Zurich and Basel. But they each played their own unique role, and there were interesting and unique figures involved in both of those cities who had such a great impact and an influence upon Reformed thought, Reformed life, Reformed practice. But the sad story is that over the centuries, Switzerland, like much of Europe, even though Switzerland is this unique and special Reformed place for a time, a lot of that is lost. And a lot of Europe, much of Europe, is, we might say, post-Christian. And even though there are vestiges of Reformed churches in Switzerland, many of them are bound up or part of the state system and are now no longer truly Reformed places practicing and preaching the true gospel. So there's all sorts of challenges, and there are many factors involved. And today, as we speak a bit about the history, I was hoping that we would also connect this to the present and then think to the future on how we might labor as faithful and Reformed Christians to seek to proclaim the gospel, and how people around the world, whether in the States, whether in Canada, whether in other parts of Europe, or our brothers and sisters in Asia and South America, we have lots of people listening, they might not know so much about what's going on in Europe. And sadly, I think some people, like, Europe is kind of a forgotten mission field. You know, we think about reaching unreached people groups. That's good. We need to do that. But there's an enormous opportunity in Europe, and many people who are craving and need the gospel. And there's a lot of work to be done, and a shortage of laborers and a shortage of resources. So my hope is that we can address those needs, perhaps, and that the Lord might call some people to work in these fields and to support this work in whatever various ways is possible. Kurt, might you talk a bit about how you ended up in Basel years ago, and then maybe a little bit of your history there in the city? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I I came to faith in Christ in 1983, and I first attended a kind of a pietistic evangelical free church, partly dispensational Baptist church. And when I started to work again, I had a long time where I was not working at all. I was part of the drug scene in Switzerland. And when I started to work again, soon started to work with drug users that were looking for a place to live, first in a kind of a house where homeless people could live. And then after that, I started to work in a withdrawal clinic for several years. And that's a time when I became more and more reformed in my convictions. I got the call for the ministry. I went to Basel, or close to Basel, to study theology in a seminary that was not reformed at all. But it was, for me, it was the only way to get an education in theology. So from there, I was looking for a church to serve. I got a call from a church in Basel. It was a dispensational church that I was trying to bring in the Reformed faith, the Reformed confession. I had a time of about 7 years where I tried that, and but I failed. People, after a time of about 5 years, they started to want to get rid of me because of my different teaching. And finally, 2008, they asked me to leave. With my convictions at that time, as a Reformed believer, believing in covenant theology, with all that belongs to that, I thought I will not find a place to serve anymore. But then I got to know two pastors from the ERKWB, ERKWB, and they finally asked me to plant a church in Basel for the ERKWB. That's when we started. We were just kind of thrown into the cold water. I had a handful of people joining me, most of them from my old church. They left the church together with me, and so I started to preach to them. We had services first in our garden. We didn't have a room for our services, so it was summer and weather was nice, so we had four or five services out in the green. And you saw the garden,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's great. I'd love to go to church there. Maybe not if it's raining, but yeah, on a nice day.
And so we had a long time of about at least 10 to 12 years where we were just a handful of people, sometimes only two, in service.
Yeah.
So I think it was one or two times I preached to my wife only. Right.
And maybe a horse.
Yeah, they were horses or cows.
Rabbits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but at about 2021, people started to come to our services. We got known a little bit more, and yeah, that was the time when our church started to grow up to about 40 to 50 visitors in a service. And we are still a church plant where not everything is really set, you know. It's a lot of fun, a lot of hard work too.
It seems like that might be some of the necessity at the moment, especially if you're not operating an international church. There are some congregations in the Arakave Bay that are an international church. Will have a larger group of people who are expats, for example, and so those will be bilingual services. Yeah. Vienna, Neuenberg, we mentioned before starting to record, and so some of those churches, at least the one in Vienna's, you know, has a place that they rent and a more established. They're not setting up chairs every Sunday. We'll put it that way, having a faithful confessional ministry in German and in Swiss German, there are challenges, and that just seems to be the state of affairs at the moment.
Yes, we intentionally do services only in German.
Yeah.
Because we, of course, we also want to reach people who live here, Swiss people.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably reach more people if you would have an English speaking congregation, because of the many expats that live in Basel. But we want to reach Swiss people.
Yeah.
Of course, everyone is welcome, and we have more non-Swiss members in our church. We have about 9 or so different nationalities.
Yeah, it felt like Isaiah 2, or maybe even Pentecost when I visited, because you have Italians, Brazilians, Dutch people, English. I was an American, so it felt like we had the United Nations in at your church in Basel.
Yes, yes. And I also pass out my written manuscript for people who are not so well known to German, so they can read along and things like that, or they can make their own translation before the services.
Yeah.
And that works pretty well.
Florian, before we get into speaking about some of the history and connecting these centuries, how did you end up serving in Zurich? And might you give us a little portrait of what weekly worship looks like at your congregation?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was always clear that I want to go back to Switzerland after my studies in the UK. I really had a heart for Switzerland and for the Reformation in Switzerland. But I initially wanted to go to the east of Switzerland because that's where I'm from. So where Zwingli was from, actually, as well. So Kurt and myself are from the east of Switzerland, where Zwingli is from, and sorting out the rest of Switzerland. No, I'm kidding. I spoke actually to an American and an American minister. And since I had kind of a strong calling for Switzerland, but not for a particular place, he was speaking to me and he said, it may be wiser to go to Zurich because there's no confessional church there apart from a Chinese fellowship, but there's nothing else really in this whole city of Zurich. And that's basically kind of then what we did. And I was sent out to Zurich. We started exploratory Bible studies in 2019, more or less exactly 500 years after Zwingli started with his Lectio Continua. So it's quite amazing how the date fit together somehow. And then we started worship service in February 2021. In Zurich. Yeah.
Now, Kurt, we walked by. We weren't able to connect with you, Florian, for scheduling reasons. When I did come through Zurich on foot, but Kurt, we walked by their meeting spot. Was that is that where you met first, or have you been in different locations, Florian?
Well, one different location, because okay. The Swiss Reformed Church had promised us a year before we had started with our worship services that we could have one of their buildings to rent it. But then just a few weeks before that, they basically called me and canceled on us because of the chapter about marriage, and they were just about voting on same-sex marriage. So we didn't have a venue, and then kindly enough, a free evangelical church in the center of Zurich opened their doors for us for the evening service. So we started with the evening service first, just evening services. And then 3 months later, the city of Zurich basically had a venue, and that's the one you probably would have seen. And then we started morning and evening services.
Yeah. This is beautiful. Well, praise the Lord for that. It's good to know. People might, we don't need to talk extensively about this, but it's another piece of the puzzle to understand that there are two state churches, two denominations effectively sponsored by the Swiss Confederation. There's a Catholic and then there's a Reformed. And so that adds another layer of complexity, because people, if they're part of a church, some people only take those to be the only serious churches. Everything else might be viewed as a splinter group or a cult group. But it also adds some linguistic complexity, because if you identify with the Reformation and you say you're a Reformed church, they might think you're part of the state church. Do you find that is that an accurate depiction of the situation?
Yeah, that's what happened in Basel. Mm-hmm. And that's also the reason why we changed our name into Presbyterian. So the family name, so to say, is Evangelische Reformierte Kirche, Westminster Confession. And when people hear Evangelisch Reformiert, they think immediately about
state church.
Reformed state church, yes. And since we changed to Presbyterian, it's a lot easier to find us because people will search for Presbyterian and not for Reformed if they are for some true Reformed or true to the Bible Reformed church.
It's quite interesting even how the different meanings of Reformed in the English-speaking world and in Switzerland. When I did my master's at Durham University, when I said to the students there, and most of them were Anglicans and not Reformed at all, but as soon as I said I'm Reformed, they thought I'm a Puritan, you know, this super conservative guy.
Right.
In Switzerland, if you say you're Reformed, generally people think you're liberal.
Liberal and part of the state church. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
So typically in the States, when I was becoming more Reformed and Calvinistic and covenantal, you typically would say Reformed and people would think Calvinist. But then there's small r Reformed, lowercase Reformed, and then uppercase Reformed. The uppercase Reformed are typically the confessional people, Pado Baptists, etc. Lowercase r in the States might refer sometimes and include Calvinistic Baptists. But then when I started to get much more involved with Mid-America Reformed Seminary, I serve on the board there. It's about an hour and a half away. And there are many people there that serve in the United Reformed Churches in North America. If you use the word Reformed in that context, they're typically speaking about continental Reformed in distinction from Presbyterian. So we're all confessional. But when I'm there, I'm not Reformed, I'm Presbyterian. And my URC brothers are Reformed, but they're not Presbyterian. So who knows? We don't have the state measure, but you have to know your context and you have to know how to communicate accurately and faithfully to the people you're trying to reach so that they understand what you're talking about. It's a challenge. So let's speak then about Zurich, about Basel quickly. We don't need to have a huge lecture time, but I at least want to set this stage because it's going to help inform us not only how the Lord worked in the past, but then thinking about how we might pursue ministry on into the future in a different type of context, but one that's not unrelated. The city of Zurich was a free imperial city of the Holy Roman Empire. It had a really strong mercantile class, but there was some growing discontent with the Roman Catholic Church. But being in the center of Switzerland made it an important city and a kind of a strategic place for reform. And there was a figure we've already mentioned, for those who might not know, Huldrych Zwingli, or Ulrich Zwingli, depending on the form of his name you want to take, was a people's priest, so to speak, in Grossmünster in Zurich in 1519. It's just an absolutely beautiful church, and you can go there today, and we took a very brief tour of it. We didn't go in the tower, right, Kurt, because it said, enter at your own risk. So we didn't. But it did have the pulpit. I presume that's not the original pulpit, but even seeing the building kind of, I mean, it was moving.
It might be the original pulpit.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, yeah. It's tremendous to see regardless.
Yeah.
And I once told my wife about how the Reformation kind of, how historians like to say the Reformation started in Switzerland, and she didn't believe me. She thought I was making this up because I'm apt to make things up like this and pass them off as true. Well, I have this peculiar joy in life, whereas if I say something ridiculous but my wife believes me, then she might repeat that to somebody someday. It's a very perverse sense of humor. But in a sense, in 1522, there was what was known as the Affair of the Sausages. This is a real thing. This isn't made up. But the Affair of the Sausages was when, there was a Lenten fast a breaking of the Lenten fast led by Froschauer, a printer, and many of Zwingli's associates. Zwingli did not eat the sausages during Lent himself, but he was there and, in a sense, approved of it. And by doing that, he was arguing for the authority of Scripture over church tradition. But that was a very revolutionary thing to do. And when we visited Switzerland, I really made it a point. I didn't do it in Zurich, but I made a point that I had to eat a sausage because I was there during Lent. So I did eat a sausage in Appenzell, but I didn't eat one in Zurich. Florian, I'm curious, does anyone on the street know any of this history? What do they think of when they think of Zwingli? Because there's a few of his names on a few things. They have some statues to him. But is there any public awareness of this history?
I mean, there will be awareness of Zwingli, Huldrych Zwingli, generally, yeah, because he's saying the signs of the Reformation still. Mm. There was not too long ago, there was even a film about Zwingli, even kind of a cinema film, and that would have brought some more awareness to it. But I would say generally the history is not very well known. It would be more known kind of as Zwingli as a stern reformer, very rigid, strict, stern reformer. And potentially also more in connection with the Anabaptists, that they were killed by Zwingli. So things like that would be probably known. And even when I look back to my school years, I had learned hardly anything about the Swiss Reformation.
Really?
I think I learned more about witches and the last burning of witches than actually the Reformation.
Wow.
So it's really sad. Yeah, there won't be much awareness of it. But of course, because you have all... you see Zwingli's statues and everything like that, you can actually point to it and you can speak to people and connect with that history in one way at least.
Wow. Well, there was some public debate. Zwingli was a really important figure, and he argued for the sufficiency of Scripture, and it led to a pretty wide-sweeping and effective reform in the city. There was the establishment of Reformed worship by 1525. There was the abolition of the Mass and an introduction of a simpler form of worship that was focused on the preaching of the Word. And there was also, of course, the great arguments and debates. And you think of the Marburg Colloquy and other things where there was a debate between Zwingli and Luther and this side of the Reformation and Lutheranism in terms of what was going on in the supper. So Zwingli, I think unfairly, is sometimes held up as a strict memorialist. That's something on my to-do list. I want to read more and understand more Zwingli on the Lord's Supper. But he's often caricatured as someone who emphasized a strict memorialist view that's all that was going on in the Lord's Supper. I'm I don't believe that was that's accurate, but that's how he's held up. And then Luther, obviously, with a view of consubstantiation. Calvin is often placed as the mediating figure who has the spiritual presence. But things aren't that simple. But that's at least what people think about when they think of Zwingli's big contributions.
Yeah, I even read recently a quote from Zwingli where he said, "We do eat Christ sacramentally and spiritually in the Lord's Supper."
There we
go. So again, you see, he definitely believed there was more to it than just a symbolical view of it.
Well, it's easier just to caricature people, but unfortunately, it's not accurate or true. That's good. We'll have to talk more about that. Maybe I can include some links in the episode description for people who'd like to follow up with that. I want to get into Heinrich Bullinger in a minute, but he's more still early, but second generation as he succeeded Zwingli there in Zurich. And I know you've done work on him, Florian, but if we might set the stage in Basel real quick. Kurt, you showed me some locations. We were able to walk to some places where Johannes Ecolampadius served, where Erasmus also was doing much of his scholarly work. And then we went to the church where Erasmus is buried. There's an inscription or a plaque to him. We don't know exactly, there isn't necessarily a grave, a headstone or a tomb or a crypt or something, but he's under that building somewhere. Tell us a bit about the history of Basel and how the Reformation came to that city.
That's an interesting story. Erasmus was in Basel from 1514, I think. And he was working there at the New Testament in Greek. He put together all these manuscripts and and he needed a helper for the especially for the quotes from the Old Testament. And Ecolampad was known to him as a very good knower of the languages, of the old languages, especially Hebrew. And he asked him to come to Basel and help him with the New Testament text and even the quotes from the Old Testament in the New. And so Ecolampad came to Basel in 1515 for the first time. And they lived in the same house. And that was because in this house was also a printer named Johannes Froben. He was one of 70 printers in Basel. And Basel at that time had only about 10,000 inhabitants, so that quite a number of printers there.
Right.
Of course, we have more today. Everyone has one in his household. But for that time, it was really a huge number.
Right.
And that was because many many authors and scholars let their stuff print in Basel. It was really a place of people who came there to study, because the University of Basel, the first university in Switzerland, was founded 1460, I think.
Wow.
That's also the reason why Erasmus was there. And in the house of Johannes Froben, the printer, and Ecolampad came there to live, and they had a house doctor, the famous Paracelsus. It's also well-known figure.
That's why we can visit that house today, and it's a museum of sorts for that reason.
But not a museum of the Reformation or something.
No, to science.
medical museum. Mm. Ecolampad came, he went back to Germany after about a year or so, and he was a preacher in his hometown, Weinsberg, in southern Germany, and he started to preach like a Lutheran. So he was convinced by Luther's writings, and after a time they got rid of him in Germany. And he basically had to flee, and he came back to Basel in 1522, and was serving there. He changed between the Münster in Basel and St. Martin's Church. I think St. Martin's was 1522 when he first started there as a vicar. And so the Reformation started in Basel. It went for about 7 years until Reformed worship was installed in Basel. Roman Catholic form of worship was abolished in 1529.
Okay. So 4 years later from Zurich. Yeah.
Yes. In between was a, there was a time of disputations and so on. A famous disputation in 23 on several several issues about the Bible and other things they discussed. And so it was a slow-growing Reformation in Basel. Oekelm Park did a lot of commentaries on Old Testament and New Testament books, and he wrote several papers on things things reformed. And so the Reformation grew, and the government of the city of Basel had to change things because of that. Because of people are, you know, the pressure was building up, and they had to do something about. And they asked Oekelm Park to teach at the University of Basel, and yeah, so it grew and grew, and 59, that's the date, 1529,
that the Reformation was established. Yeah, that yes. People can read quite a bit about Johannes Ecolampadius. We've interviewed Diane Portress in the past, and I'll try to include a link to some of those conversations in the episode description, but she's written an extensive biography that was published as a dissertation, well, submitted as a dissertation, but there's also a shorter, more accessible version that you can read if you'd like to learn more about that history. And Calvin also spent some time in Basel. Kurt, I believe you mentioned to me before that he spent about 15, he took about 15 trips to Basel, so there's also some additional history there.
The first time was when he fled from France. That was in 34, I think. He was in Basel 34 to 36, where he had studies, time for studies, and he was the scene was very friendly to the Reformed confession, people who studied there, and Calvin was one of them, and he wrote the first edition of his institutes there and printed it in 36 with another printer. That one was called Plato.
One of the 70. That's good. Well, if this would have happened in Austria, I'm sure we could go there and they would show us the specific building and the machine that was used to print the institutes. Kurt has informed me of how the Austrians like to have their stories Florian, I'd love to continue this history, but if you might talk to us a bit about what happened in Zurich after Zwingli. Heinrich Bullinger succeeded Zwingli at Grossmünster in 1531, if my research is correct. Yeah. What was that transition like, and what were some new things that that Bullinger added to the Reformation? How did he advance the work of the church there in the city?
Yeah, well, he took over in a very kind of shaky period after the death of Zwingli, and of course the Reformed cities lost the war, so they had to make concessions as well. There were some groups in Zurich that wanted to go back to the old faith, which was, of course, a Roman Catholic faith in their books. And he was really the man who basically stabilized the Reformation. But he came in and was already a bit involved in a bit of a controversy, because the city council asked him, or basically required him, not to preach on politics anymore, because Zwingli, in their view, overdid it in the past.
Yeah.
So Bullinger asked for some time to consider this with his fellow ministers, and they came back and said that they can't keep that requirement, because the Bible does mention politicians, and sometimes when they come to appropriate text, they have to denounce the sins of politicians as well. And in the end, actually, the city of Zurich allowed them to preach on the text they have in front of them. And that was basically kind of called the controversy on the freedom of the word of God, which was, of course, extremely important. But he kind of stabilized the Reformation. And of course, Bullinger is known particularly for his coming out on theology, that he was one of the first ones in the Reformed circles to speak of this eternal covenant in 1534. Was his first writing, and then 1537, his second one on the old faith, which is particularly interesting just by the name, because of course Roman Catholics said, we have the old faith.
Right.
And in that writing, he's basically proving that, no, we Protestants have the old faith, and he starts with the faith of Adam and Eve and continues through the whole scriptures what the old faith is, and then also a little bit goes into the early church history. So it's quite an interesting writing. But what is maybe a bit lesser known is that he was quite important, in my view, as well, when it came to some pastoral matters. He was really a pastor. Of course, all the reformers were really pastors.
Yeah, certainly.
But he was very, he was a very sensitive pastor, even when he comes. And of course, there are a bit debates about his view on predestination. We don't have time to go into it. It's a very interesting topic. But it's really interesting that when he goes in the decades into predestination, he immediately goes basically to the pastoral application. And he doesn't like to talk too much about predestination or speculative theology. And in the decades as well, he's really building a foundational theology. Sometimes it's almost a bit tedious to read through it, because some things we would think, well, of course, we understand this should be this, or the should be kind of like this. But because, of course, he was speaking into a into the medieval time, he was kind of building a reformed foundation. And of course, particularly where his impact was felt was in England, where kind of Bullinger was extremely important. And maybe something else to mention is also how important for him the regulative principle was in many ways. So the first sermon he held in Bremgarten, and that's before his time in Zurich, he did not preach on John 3:16 or Romans 3. He actually preached on John 4, worshiping God in spirit and truth.
Yeah.
And that was really important for Bullinger to worship God aright. And you see that even in the decades, how he emphasizes again and again that in vain do they worship me, because they follow the commandments of man, from Matthew 15. So I really appreciate Bullinger, and I appreciate that I can't speak about Bullinger. As I said, I don't know that much about Zwingli.
Yeah, sure.
But Bullinger just interested me. It's kind of a bit of a funny story, because I share his birthday.
So. Oh, there you go.
So, of course, 500 years earlier him, but so that's initially probably why I got a little bit interested into him.
Well, sure, and then having that history in your city. Where does the Second Helvetic Confession come in, and is that something that has any lasting or enduring influence in Switzerland?
Yes. Well, that's 1566, of course, right, when it was published. It is considered, there's still a little bit of debate, but it's kind of the consensus is that previously it had been his personal confession, which he also kind of passed on when he actually had the plague a little bit earlier as well, passed on already to the city council. But how it basically came to be published in Switzerland was because of a controversy in Heidelberg that Friedrich III, the Kurfürst there, he got into trouble because of his Heidelberg catechism, that the Lutheran lords and Fürsten, they didn't really like the Swiss influence of theology in Heidelberg, particularly when it came to the Lord's Supper. And then this Friedrich III was called to the Reichstag by the emperor. And one item on the agenda was how to deal with kind of the sects that are creeping in Germany. And they meant actually the Swiss Reformation. And so Friedrich III basically writes to Beza in Geneva and to Bulling in Zurich and basically asking him for help for a theological rationale. And Beza wanted to send something as well, but because Bulling are in 1565, he had already his kind of confession ready and he sent it in Latin. And then Friedrich writes back and says, can that not have more weight to it that maybe the other Swiss cities would also confirm it? So Bullinger sent it to Geneva and all the different Swiss Protestant cities. And Geneva wanted to change one or two things, Bern as well. It's quite interesting what each of them wanted to change. But in the end, it was basically published 1566 as the Second Helvetic Confession. And that was kind of valid and binding in the Swiss Reformed Church until the beginning of the 19th century. And then it was basically kicked out. And the Swiss Reformed Church is now officially non-confessional. And I think the only church that kind of in Europe still has is the Hungarian Reformed Church. They still hold to the Second Helvetic Confession.
The Austrian Reformed.
Even as well. Thank you, Claude. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, I was able to speak with some brothers that had done some work and published an edited volume on the Genevan Revet. And talking a bit about some of the revivals in the 1800s in Geneva. Other than that, though, what happened after? That's a large question. I know we don't have much time, but I want to get to speak a bit about the present need, especially in Basel and Zurich, but in Switzerland more broadly and Europe more broadly. But in large measure, what are some big picture factors involved in how the Reformation was eventually kind of lost, where we don't have it anymore, at least in the way we did in the 16th century?
I would guess that an important role is the one the German theology played, the German historisch-kritische Methode that somehow came out of Pietism or came along with Pietism. They developed a new kind of understanding of Wissenschaft, theological science, and started to remove everything that's not material. They had a really materialist understanding.
Naturalist, you
know,
right?
And guys who removed all the miracles and things that are natural, material, the Entmythologisierung, New Testament. It became only a moral kind of teaching.
Or experiential, too, or the Gefühl of Schleiermacher and others.
All these guys, and they were able to deconstruct and I think another reason is why this could happen is that the confession was removed. They didn't use any confession anymore, and so nobody was bound to a system of doctrine that is,
Well, even then, in the early 20th century, even if people were rejecting liberalism, many people jumped on the bandwagon, so to speak, and started to follow the theology of Karl Barth. He was viewed, and he's Swiss. Sadly, a lot of the Swiss Reformed just all became Barthians. They didn't necessarily become liberals, but as Cornelius Van Til might categorize, and I agree with him, that Barthianism is the new modernism, or it's another form of religion altogether. That's my assessment. Not everyone agrees with that. But when I was taking a class at the Catholic Theological Society of America, when I'm interacting with Catholics and they ask me what I am and I say I'm Reformed, they think Barth. That's what they think Reformed is. Yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah. If I may piggyback on something Kurt said as well about kind of the German influence, I think one factor would have been as well that in Switzerland, apart from Basel, for a very long time, there wasn't actually a university. There was some theological education, but Zurich didn't have a university. Tübingen, of course, and in Germany, exactly.
Marburg,
So they had to all go to Germany to study, and therefore there was a lot of influence from Germany. And one, I mean, that would be very interesting to do more research on, but it's maybe a little bit one of my theories. But I think what is very, very important is even the Reformation, what the Swiss Reformation didn't do very well is thinking through ecclesiology in terms of the difference between state and church, and that the church ought to do church discipline. And that was really then also decisive for this, for the abolition, I think, of the Second Helvetic Confession. Because in Zurich, it was kind of, if you weren't Orthodox in Zurich, you were exiled from the Zurich rather than exiled from the church. And of course, then the pressure on the confession grows much more if the whole populace has to basically hold to the confession. And then you have lots of people who are actually not born again Christians, and that pressure is very difficult to resist then to at some point then just remove the Second Helvetic Confession.
Oh good, that's amazing. We'll have to follow up with another conversation about that. Now, I know we need to respect our time, especially since I'm talking to two Swiss brothers, because we've got to be very precise with our time and with our schedule. So I if you have to leave. And I like that. I like that. So I'm all for it. But if you have to leave, I know, Florian, you've got a heart out. And so if I ask a question, if this is going to take too long, please, by all means, you're excused. But I would like maybe to offer some suggestions or make an appeal to our listeners. How might, you know, what are some of the present needs right now in your congregations and in your denominations? And how might people prayerfully consider, how might they appeal to the Lord that he would provide? And how might somebody even maybe get involved in learning more and maybe they feel called to come and to help labor in Switzerland and to recover some of this lost Reformation? Do you have anything on your minds or anything on your heart? What are their specific needs?
We need workers. workers that are able to endure in a hard setting for a longer time, maybe. Workers that are able to speak German more or less fluently. Church planters. We have. I got many questions from other parts of Switzerland, especially the Bern area.
People that are inquiring about a Reformed church, right? So potential core group people.
Yeah. And if we could provide a good man who could take over a church plant or something, that would be great. Even other places, Tony Curto is thinking about planting a church in the St. Gallen area. He needs at least a brother who is able to work there. And
Florian, do you find similar things in EPQ? And I know you're partnering with one another, and OPC loves both your denominations, but you're in a little bit different context, not only a different city, but a different ecclesiastical arrangement. What are the particular needs in Zurich?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly kind of stress what Kurt said in terms of church planters, and just maybe add one or two things. Mm-hmm. They need to kind of have some grit and to be to know that it can be a very kind of long, hard work, because again, you have to lift up people to a certain kind of to a certain degree up again, that you can't assume many things. It takes a long time to have office bearers even, because they come from a total different theological framework. So we need to have godly, well-trained men who speak German and would come and plant churches. And of course, we hope we have some men soon at some point from the Swiss themselves. But that's, of course, sometimes a bit difficult as well and takes some time.
Right. Yeah. To have that cathedral thinking, that cathedral thinking, Kurt. If we want to build a cathedral, we need wood. And if we need that much wood, we have to plant a forest. And then someone's got to take care of and cultivate that forest. And that's kind of the stage that the church is in right now in terms of developing indigenous ministers and officers to serve the people in Switzerland. But it's the same is true in Austria and Germany in many cases. So there's going to be a transitional period, and we can use people right now. So we need to send qualified ministers and officers, maybe even some church planters. Maybe there's some people that could take a job in Zurich or something like that, and they're willing to go. That would be great. Mm-hmm. But the ideal is that you would have a healthy indigenous church that was in ecumenical fellowship with confessional churches around the world, that they themselves were sending out their own missionaries to other countries. That's the long-term goal leading up to the return of Christ. But if we can't do that right now, then we pray that we can work through a transitional period where we'd have fluent German speakers, no matter their nationality, but qualified men to serve in these ministries. There's a great need. There's lots of other things we can talk about, lots of other things we're thinking and praying about in terms of theological education and in providing resources, not just educational resources, but even finances. So if any of that is on your mind, if the Lord is perhaps moving you and you're feeling compelled to help or would like to learn more, if you would like to visit, maybe attend a church service someday in Basel or Zurich, let us know, and we'll connect you to the brothers, and maybe I'll go along with you because I'd love to come back. Brothers, I know we got I'm a little bit over time, but thank you so much for joining me. This has been a blessing to me. I'd love to have you back soon and talk more about these matters, and we'll certainly keep you in prayer. But thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
We want to point everyone to the various websites. I'll have links in the episode description where you can learn more about EPQ. You can learn more about the ERKWB and the work of the Reformation, the continuing Reformation in Switzerland. And you can find information about our program and all of our offerings, upcoming events, publications, etc., at reformedforum.org. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.